Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Acetaminophen is found in more than 600 different medicines. It's practically everywhere, and about a quarter of all Americans take acetaminophen every week to treat minor aches and pains. Research has revealed, however, an unexpected potential side effect. Joining us is the lead author of the research, a member of the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center Institute for Behavioral Medicine Research, Dr. Baldwin Way. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Your research found that acetaminophen users had dulled positive emotions and were less empathetic than those who didn't take the painkiller. How was the research conducted?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, the motivation behind this research is built on theory that's been developed over the last 20, 30 years. People have been studying physical pain, of course, and acetaminophen is well known as a physical painkiller. It reduces your hurt to your wrist or your headache or the like. But one of the things that's been coming out over the last 10 years is that there may be some overlap in the brain areas and the neurochemical systems in the brain that how we respond to social pain, the pain of being left out, excluded, rejected, dumped, and the like, that there seems to be similar overlap in the brain areas for how we respond to pain. And so this has raised questions in people's minds about how do we process the pain in others? Do we process it through our own experiences? And so there was work done to look at the brain activation when somebody was experiencing pain. So if I was in a brain scanner and somebody put painful stimulus on my arm, and then also maybe watching my spouse receive the same pain, and found very similar brain activation, seemingly suggesting that how I relate to you when you're feeling something adverse or feeling some painful experience is that I put myself in your shoes. Or to pick up on the theme from the previous section, as Bill Clinton was known to say in 1992, I feel your pain.
Right.
He empathized with the pain of those who were suffering economic maladies. And so one of the ways that we may do that is we put ourselves in somebody else's shoes. And so the thought was, if Tylenol reduces my own pain, that's been known for a number of years, might it reduce my ability to feel your pain? And so that was the motivation for doing this study.
Why the focus on acetaminophen? Why not aspirins?
We'll be moving to that soon.
Okay.
The thought is that acetaminophen is a drug that reduces the central, in other words, the brain aspects of pain. Aspirin tends to act more at the site of the pain. So if you have a pain in your joint, for example, aspirin would act there to reduce the pain, which would reduce the signals to your brain, whereas acetaminophen seems to have less effect at your knee but would have more effect in your brain.
And the hypothesis being that this is a brain activity issue. What do we know about the psychological connection between pain and empathy then? Is it that walking in someone else's shoes? Is it important?
It seems to be important. There seems to be what researchers call an experience-sharing component of how we connect with others, so that when, for example, just before when we went on air, you were talking about your wrist and it having hurt your wrist, and I would put myself in your shoes and think, oh, how would my wrist feel if I'd fallen on it, and how painful would that feel? And that would be the way I connect with you and your experience of that pain, was by simulating it in my own brain, my own mind.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the relationship between acetaminophen and empathy. It has been found to maybe at least correlates with lesser empathy in people who use it than not. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So this is a correlation. There's not necessarily an understanding of what the chemical properties
we did
are.
We did several experiments where we actually gave participants, in one condition they took acetaminophen, in another condition they took an inactive placebo. So they didn't know which condition they were in. And so we actually did experimentally manipulate the drug condition. So in one condition, they would read scenarios about somebody who had suffered some sort of physical ailment, stepped on a nail, slipped and scraped their shin on a rock, and also some social pain is scenarios of being rejected from college or being excluded from a dating opportunity. And so we found in the acetaminophen condition that there was a reduction in your distress, the amount of pain you thought the other person was experiencing.
But couldn't that be just a function of the fact that the acetaminophen killed pain in you and, or, you know, that you're not feeling as much pain yourself?
It could be, and that's part of the thought is that it's affecting the same circuitry.
So I see. Can you tell us about that part of the brain that is responsible for empathy? What happens to that under acetaminophen?
Yes. Nobody's actually done that study. We can infer from other work that there's been one brain imaging study to look at acetaminophen, and it seemed to have its primary effect in brain areas that are involved in physical pain. Probably no surprise there. And we can infer from other work that that when people are looking at somebody experiencing pain, so in other words, empathizing with somebody else's pain, it activates those same brain areas that are active in physical pain as if I were experiencing it. And so the assumption would be that acetaminophen is going to reduce those brain areas that are involved in perception of our own pain.
How do you measure empathy when you're studying this?
Well, that's a trick. That's a challenge that I think the field has been facing for a number of years. In this particular study, we just asked people, how much empathy do you feel? In several ways. One is we asked them, how much pain do you see this other person? How much pain do you perceive in this other person? Another way is to ask them, how distressed do I feel? How uncomfortable? And then also we asked them how much concern or how much sympathy they had for somebody else who was suffering. In other words, how much, how soft-hearted do you feel? How compassionate do you feel? How tender or moved do you feel towards?
Like on a 1 to 10 basis?
On a 1 to 10 scale, yeah.
And what were the differences? Is there any way to summarize how much different they reacted than the people who were taking the placebos?
Yeah, we're looking at around a 15% reduction in your ability to empathize or feel the pain of another.
In another experiment, participants experienced was called white noise when I read about it, unpleasant sound blasts, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they were asked to rate the pain of others. Why that?
The goal there was just to see when I'm experiencing pain, how much to actually a physical pain. So some of these, I described that we had in our first study, people read about scenarios, which was our first foray. In the second study, we had people watch somebody else be socially excluded and left out. They came into the experiment, they chatted with this person, got to know them, and then saw them get left out of a social interaction. And so that was an actual experience mimicked in the lab of watching where you could empathize with somebody, and acetaminophen again reduced your empathy for that scenario. The idea behind these noise blasts was to actually measure physical pain rather than just some of these scenarios where you're watching somebody else. And that's where we also saw a reduction there in your ability to understand how much somebody else was experiencing that pain.
You also found that participants had dulled positive emotions. I mentioned that at the outset. Mm-hmm. What's the distinction between what's a dulled positive emotion? How do you measure that?
Yeah, so that was a different study that we'd done. That was work by Jeff Durso. And what he did there was showed people images of positive things like a couple in a romantic moment or a cute puppy or a beach scene or a baby. And participants were given in that study were either given placebo or acetaminophen, and just asked to rate how positive, on a 1 to 10 scale, positive or negative, is this image. And we found there that people who received acetaminophen in two separate studies, we found this that those who'd seen the positive images showed rated them less positively. So in other words, if you saw for example, this couple in a romantic moment, if you were on placebo, you tended to rate this as an 8 on the positive scale, and on acetaminophen, you rated it about a 6. Mm. So you saw less positivity in these images.
So less apt to cry in a poignant scene in a movie kind of a thing.
That would be on the negative side, yes. Yeah. So we found the same thing with negative images as well.
Sort of dulled emotions generally.
Generally overall blunted emotions, yes. Huh.
Is there any sense or understanding about how long these side effects might last after taking acetaminophen? And by the way, what about the dosage that was used in these experiments?
Oh, good point. Yes. The dosage we used in these studies was 1,000 milligrams, which is the standard extra strength dose that you would take if you have a headache. That's what's on the side of the bottle. So these are standard doses that people are taking. The duration of the effect would probably be several hours. We haven't studied the effect over protracted periods of time, but my suspicion is, or I would expect, that the drug effect, these effects on reduced emotions would only last for a while the drug is in your body. And once it's excreted or metabolized and gone, it would be no longer having an effect on these side effects.
It would be really interesting to see the contrast in how they respond.
Between before and after the drug, yes. We haven't done the studies. We tend to do our studies comparing people
to each other
rather than over time. Those are just for scientific reasons. It's more easy to do those studies.
Yeah. It's known that pain can also have psychological effects, especially chronic pain. Is there any connection there?
In terms of we haven't studied the effects in chronic pain. So how acute pain transitions to a chronic pain is a very interesting topic that we haven't focused on. So.
And I also wondered about people when you're screening for your participants in these studies. Do you want people who are relatively clean? In other words, they're not chronic users of acetaminophen?
Well, for safety reasons, we want to make sure that they're not currently taking acetaminophen.
Okay. Because you don't want to over... Yeah.
We don't want to give them an overdose. But we assume that there's a certain percentage of people that will be experiencing pain, but because of the way we do our experiments, they'll be just as likely to be. We'll have a similar number in our placebo condition as we'll have in our drug condition. So,
is there a similar effect, or is someone looking at whether there's a similar effect with other pain relievers? I mean, we talked about aspirin, and you mentioned that, well, that does something different than what acetaminophen does, but are there other pain relievers that do sort of the same thing?
Right. There's a common class of pain relievers that most everyone has probably taken, such as ibuprofen or Advil. Aspirin is in that same class. They have overlapping effects with acetaminophen, very similar effects. As I mentioned earlier, they affect this one pain pathway in both the brain and the body, whereas acetaminophen just affects this in the brain.
Okay.
We've begun to study the effects of ibuprofen and did not see as robust of effects, but those very early unpublished work, so we really need to. There's some methodological improvements in those studies we could do. So at this point, I would say the jury's still out on whether other painkillers have similar effects.
What about opioids?
Opioids do have, those are obviously much more powerful effects and act on different systems. But I would expect that to some extent that they could have similar effects.
And what further research? I mean, you've mentioned some things you want to look into deeper. Where does this take you?
Well, I think one of the interesting questions is empathy is involved in a lot of important processes. As I mentioned a minute ago, one of the reasons Bill Clinton was such an effective politician is he was able to, as he said, "I feel your pain." This led people to feel a sense of connection. He felt like he understood them. He felt like they perceived his problems. So that this can lead to a social bond. And so if a social closeness to somebody when they empathize with your suffering, and we do this all the time, and you say, "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that," you feel closer to that person rather than if somebody says, "Oh, sucks to be you. That's terrible. I'm sorry to hear."
And they like you more.
Yeah. Right. And so it raises a question of how is acetaminophen affecting social closeness. Another component of empathy is when we see somebody suffering, this motivates us to give or care for them or donate to charities for those who are suffering. The prototypical example of a starving kid in Africa, this can motivate you. Does acetaminophen blunt this? Does it blunt your closeness in others? And another one that we are actively pursuing is the role in aggression or antisocial behavior. If one of the things that probably keeps our aggressive behavior in check and inhibited is thinking about the consequences of our actions. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have a conflict with a coworker or your spouse, one of the things that might keep you from saying that nasty thing or that mean thing is you think about how would they feel, how would my wife feel if I said this? And if you think about how pained they would be by that, how hurt they would be by that, if you're on acetaminophen, you might think, let's say if your wife's the key button issue for her is you tell her you're just like your mother. Mm-hmm. And normally that you would rate that as an 8 on how negative she would react. Well, if you're on acetaminophen, that might be a 6, and you might be more likely to say that nasty thing to your wife because you're not anticipating how negatively it would hurt her.
It makes me think about all the people who make comments on the anonymous comments on social media.
At the bottom of those web pages, yes. Yeah. I think that is part of it, is that they are the person they're commenting on isn't in front of them. They don't have to see their negative emotional reaction. They don't have to see how hurt that person is by their negative caustic comments.
And as I mentioned, about a quarter of all Americans take acetaminophen every week.
Yes, yes.
So it's a huge population worth paying attention to.
Yes, yes, it is.
Well, Dr. Baldwin Way, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Baldwin Way, he's an assistant professor of psychology and a member of the Ohio State Wexner Medical Center Institute for Behavioral Medicine Research. We will continue with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. To Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The American Academy of Pediatrics last week updated its advice to parents on infant sleeping. The guidelines suggest that babies should sleep in the same room as their parents up to the first year of their lives. Pediatrician and neonatologist Jane Scott wrote about that and more in her new book entitled The Confident Parent, A Pediatrician's Guide to Caring for Your Little One Without Losing Your Joy, Your Mind, or Yourself. She joins us now. Dr. Scott, welcome.
Good morning.
Babies and sleep may be one of the most stressful experiences for a parent, especially new parents. Why should parents try to keep babies in the same room up to that first year?
Yes, it's because there is definitely a protective effect by keeping their babies sleeping in their bedroom against sudden infant death syndrome, probably about a 50% protection rate. What the Academy is suggesting is that bed sharing is probably the practice that they absolutely should not participate in.
Why is that?
So many of the infant deaths that occur in the first year of life actually come from babies being smothered in their parents' beds. We in America, even if we think we have a nice firm mattress, tend to sleep with all sorts of fluffy pillows and comforters and the pillow top mattresses, and that's really the problem for these babies.
So if you are going to do where you have the baby in your room, what are the best circumstances for doing that? Should it be one of those cribs that are attached to the bed? Should it be right next to you? Should it be across the room? How does that work?
Yeah. They can do any one of those practices, whichever feels the best. Basically, they need to have their own space. So if they have one of these attachments to the bed, they really need to have the barrier between the baby and the parent. But something that the parent can actually work with with great convenience in the middle of the night when we're tired and the baby needs to be fed, I actually think it's a little better if they would just pull a bassinet right up to the bedside, and that's not very far away from mom, even if she has to just get up briefly, do the feeding, get baby back into that bassinet, and try to continue her sleep for the night.
The American Academy of Pediatrics also addressed tired parents falling asleep when feeding a baby and that this could be dangerous for the child. What's your advice to parents who sleep well, who do that, who are feeding and fall asleep, if even just sitting on a couch.
Yeah, that's really one of the situations that causes problems. I really think that there are other things to do to share your village a little bit, and certainly sitting up in a more upright location, having some lighting available, and having your partner maybe joining you on some of these, or at least being awake while you do the feeding for a short period of time. I actually advocate having some help. Around the world, people get help a lot when they have a new baby to try to avoid these exhausted parents. The other thing that I do in my book is I actually go through some tips on how to help to teach baby to actually go to sleep without the parent needing to be rocking and doing these other things. And with that, parents get more sleep than seems to occur when the baby is just perhaps demand feeding and then just sleeping in mom's arms. They wake up every hour or so. It's a very exhausting experience.
You've raised your children in other countries. You've spent a lot of time in Europe, Australia, and South Africa. How do other countries view the issue of co-sleeping and that kind of a thing?
Yeah. Certainly, there are countries in Asia and so forth that do co-sleep with their children. The thing that's very interesting about that, Anne, is that their numbers of sudden infant death are very low. And I believe the reason is that they really do sleep on much, much firmer mattresses. They don't have this sort of thick, heavy comforter and big fluffy pillows and so forth a lot of the time where they're doing that sort of activity. So at least in the Asian countries, you see a different practice being performed. Places like Australia, they're tending to follow our patterns much more than more of that Western culture, and they do not sleep in the bed with the baby very often. I mean, obviously, there's going to be exceptions, but their philosophy is that's not safe.
Let's talk about some other issues that pop up in your book. You write that you've met a lot of well-meaning parents so determined to protect their children that they end up putting them in danger. What do you mean by that? Can you give us some examples?
Certainly. There's a lot of safety advice out there that's being given, actually, from medical providers. The trouble is the parents, because they're so concerned about the safety of their children, have taken it to a degree that's far beyond what has been really advised to them. For instance, you need to have your baby travel in the car in a car seat. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean to say the baby needs to stay in the car seat after you've done the travel. And, of course, these companies have provided these carriers that clip into the car, and then mom can unclip them, and then baby's perhaps resting or may not be resting, and she will pick the car seat up by the handle and continue to keep that baby in the car seat. Mm-hmm. While that is a safe practice, it's really limiting the amount of movement that these babies are experiencing. So even at the other end, when they arrive perhaps at a friend's home, they will often leave the baby in that car seat if the baby's quiet. What I'm advocating is get them out, put them on your knee, hold them, give them a more normal biological movement. They do really need that. It's very important. Even young infants, certainly as they get older, they need to have more time out of these various containers. But even the young infant biologically it needs to have a certain amount of that contact with the mother or other caretaker. And the biology of the human infant is to have some degree of movement around, perhaps sitting on their hip or being held in their arms.
What are some other examples of how people are overprotective?
I think that they're overprotective many times in feeding. Parents are, again, so desirous of doing the right thing. Many moms are going onto the internet and reading and sometimes coming away with the wrong concept, where they have become very nervous that if they feed the babies different foods, even when they're ready to feed at 6 months, that they might get allergies. And so they're withholding a number of, in fact, many foods because they're so worried that the babies might get allergies. And what's very interesting is that the studies are showing that children overseas where the parents have continued to use older techniques and actually provide, believe it or not, nuts in early foods are far less likely to have allergies as they grow up than the child who is actually being completely protected for the first years of life.
Talking with Dr. Jane Scott. She's a pediatrician, neonatologist, and author of a new book. It's entitled The Confident Parent, A Pediatrician's Guide to Caring for Your Little One Without Losing Your Joy, Your Mind, or Yourself. How big of a risk is it that losing your joy part of parenting these days?
I think that if you lose your joy, it's going to affect your babies. It's not just going to affect you. These babies are extremely sensitive to your feelings. If you're anxious and upset, you're going to interact differently with the baby. So it's super important that this doesn't happen. And unfortunately, the problem is not just in small groups. I believe that parents, while they are say they're very happy to have their new babies, I believe that there's such a lot of pressure for moms and dads to provide so much and be such perfect parents that it's almost unattainable, and that adds financial stress to them because they're meant to be providing all these things that babies really don't actually need. And I believe that it affects the whole relationship in the home, and it certainly is not a good thing for the child.
Hmm. How do we know how sensitive babies are to their parents' emotions?
I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. When I was practicing pediatrics, even up to a year ago, if I would have a mom come in who was very distressed, feeding wasn't going well, of course, therefore the baby couldn't sleep, baby was crying a lot, they would come and they would sit down, and many times that baby was fretful. It was fussy. It was crying and it was wiggling and it was clearly uncomfortable. I would often offer, let me help you just a moment, and I would take the baby. And because I wasn't uptight, it was remarkable how quickly the baby would just relax and go to sleep. The feeling was palpable. And it made the parent feel much more comfortable because now the baby wasn't crying. And I would make sure to support that mom so that she could, in the same way, become more comfortable. Many of these things are easy to fix. They really are easy to fix. They just need to get the guidance and the help to just stop this stress and upset many, many times.
A lot, you know, that's one of the things as far as getting the guidance and the help. A lot of parents are pretty isolated.
You're right. We're in an era where many young ladies have moved from their home area where they actually have no perhaps sisters or mothers available, so they're making new friends, and that's a wonderful thing. But many times the friends don't really understand the problem to really be the support that they need, and many times they will defer to the internet, where unfortunately guidance may be meaningful to me when I read it. It's not necessarily interpreted easily by the parent.
So you talk about gathering your village. What do you mean by that? I mean, that's kind of a conscious effort to create that support system?
Yes. Americans are wonderful people. As you know, I've lived all over the world. Americans are gregarious. They really like being kind to one another. But so often I find that moms aren't comfortable to ask for help. It's almost like that would suggest that they're not performing as expected in their role as a parent. Therefore, they're not reaching out. Or if somebody offers help, they often won't even take the help again because they feel guilty that maybe they're not performing as they should. So, yeah, gather the village. People love to come and help. Try to arrange that there are people that will maybe help you in the home, help you with meals. There's so many ways that they can have help. And the other thing is look to your partner. It's very, very helpful to get dad involved. Or your significant other. It brings them in. It makes them feel like they're helpful, and they can definitely provide a resource of, let's have you go and get an early night tonight. Let me stay up with the baby for the late night feed. There's so many opportunities to do this.
Discipline is a huge issue. It's changed a lot in this country over time. What do you make of it?
I would like to feel that discipline is not punishment. They're really not the same thing. For me, discipline is helping your child to be guided through, to have behaviors that are ultimately desirable, respect, sharing with their friends, being cooperative. All of those things are really what we're trying to achieve. The thing about it is that children under five actually don't have the executive function, so they don't have that rational thinking that children, once they've reached around five and can go to school, that you can really pursue this too much. So many times the younger child is struggling to gain skills and learn and model from their family, but what they really need is to be accepted, to be loved, to be cared for the child to feel that they're in a secure environment, even if they make some comments that may not appear socially acceptable. We shouldn't give the kids the shame because they really can't do much about it. They're in that emotional stage that they really are trying very hard. They need to be loved and cared for, and they will come out at five doing all these nice things that you want if you've shown them that sort of respect and modeling.
Dr. Jean Scott, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Anne. Bye-bye.
Dr. Jane Scott, pediatrician, neonatologist, and author of The Confident Parent, A Pediatrician's Guide to Caring for Your Little One Without Losing Your Joy, Your Mind, or Yourself. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Everybody, especially children, needs sleep. But like adults, children can be prone to snoring and breathing through the mouth during sleep. possible signs of a more serious problem known as sleep-disordered breathing. Dentists are starting to play a role in treating those disorders. Joining us is Dr. Michael Feruzian. He specializes in sleep apnea, children's orthodontics, and is a member of the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine. Dr. Feruzian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Why is this a role for dentists and not pediatricians?
Sleep disordered breathing is a very general term given to sleep disorders that affect breathing. And as dentists, we are very much involved in breathing as the mouth develops and proper tongue posture and proper nasal breathing. So we are at the forefront, I believe, and we see our patients quite frequently, and we can address and identify issues with their sleeping patterns and certain signs and symptoms that we look for dentally.
Is this something that you work with in tandem with a pediatrician or what?
We try to work as a team, yes. Anytime I have a patient who I suspect of some type of sleep disorder breathing, I get in touch with their pediatrician and get them involved and ask some questions, perhaps even find out about a referral to an ear, nose, throat doctor to have their tonsils and adenoids checked. Mm-hmm. Although we do that as part of our dental exam, as a routine part of our dental exam. But if it needs further evaluation, that would be the time to speak with a pediatrician.
What are some of the red flags for you as a dentist that pop up that suggest there might be an issue?
The main thing I look for is tongue posture. When it comes to breathing, the role of the tongue, I think, has been way underestimated. And in recent years, it's become more and more known that the tongue plays a huge role in proper breathing, as well as the ability to breathe normally through your nose. Mouth breathing is not really the proper way to breathe, and the tongue plays a huge role in that. So as I examine a child, I'm looking for where they're positioning their tongue. What does their jaw development look like for their age? Are they developing normally? Do they have a very high palate? That's usually an indication that the tongue posture is not correct. Normally, the tongue should be resting up against the palate that develops the maxillary or the upper arch, which also affects the development of the nasal cavity. The floor of the nasal cavity is basically the roof of the mouth. So those are things I look for. Dark circles under the eyes.
Which shows that you're just not getting enough sleep.
Exactly. And then I start asking some questions from the parent. Is the child fidgety? Do they have concentration issues? Are they disruptive? So there are a host of signs and symptoms that we look at.
And you said this sleep disordered breathing can pop up with a lot of different symptoms, like, as you know, tiredness, distraction, fidgetiness, maybe being diagnosed as ADHD.
Absolutely, that's actually one of the symptoms. Kids behave very differently due to lack of sleep versus adults. Kids become hyperactive and they get very fidgety, whereas adults usually get more tired and more lethargic. So that's definitely one of the things that we ask about.
When I was reading the materials to prepare for the show, there was an illustration of just photographs of a child at the age of 10, 14, and 16 or something, and it showed how he developed and how sleep-disordered breathing affected actually what he looked like. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, is it something physical that's causing the disorder, or does the disorder cause physical changes?
That's a great question, and I think it does go both ways. I think if we go back to the child's development, it really starts at birth. There is a huge difference between breastfeeding and bottle feeding. The breastfeeding process actually starts to develop the tongue posture that's so important for the development of the jaw bones.
Healthy development.
Healthy,
right?
Development, mm-hmm. Right. Bottle feeding is very different. The action of the tongue is totally different between bottle feeding and breastfeeding. So from that point forward, the whole cascading effect can begin. And as the child becomes more and more dependent on bottle milk, the tongue posture starts to change, so the development of the jaws begins to be affected. Not only that, there's a huge problem with milk allergies in children. Cow's milk is really not designed for growing babies. So they start to develop allergies, which causes nasal blockage. So they become mouth breathers from a very, very early age. And this just continues throughout their development and growth.
Is this something that parents can observe in their babies?
Absolutely. We, in fact, recommend and encourage parents to watch their babies while they're sleeping, and even their young children, to really observe them or record them somehow. See how they're sleeping, especially early in the morning. Are they sleeping with their mouth open? Are they snoring? Are they thrashing around? Can they hear them talking in their sleep? There's a lot of things that they can look for. And, of course, you know, behavioral issues at home or at school.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sleep-disordered breathing in young children, babies on up. My guest is Dr. Michael Feruzian. He's a pediatric dentist and orthodontist at the Center for Family and Cosmetic Dentistry here in Columbus. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Feruzian, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is it possible that it's hereditary? Is there something you could be asking the parents about their own history?
Sure. There's definitely a genetic component to this problem of sleep disordered breathing, because there are certain anatomic features that the child can inherit from a parent or a grandparent. And so that is part of our questionnaire. We ask about any sleep issues with mom or dad, or any concerns that they've had, or past history of mom or dad having issues with sleep themselves. So there's definitely a genetic component.
How common is this?
A recent study found that about 1-3% of children between the ages of 5 and 17 have this issue in one form or another. And that same study found that 9 out of 10 children had at least one symptom of sleep-disordered breathing. And so I think the problem is much more prevalent than we realize. I think we just need to be looking for the signs and symptoms.
When should parents have their child looked at by a medical professional, you know, just with even just one symptom? Or what do you recommend?
I would say by age 2, they really need to be looking at how the child is sleeping, how they're breathing, how they're swallowing. And as they begin to speak, speech is a big, big factor as well. Speech development, pronunciation of certain words and certain vowels and sounds are more difficult for children with breathing problems. So as early as age 2 would be a good time to begin to really look at them closely.
Now, dentists can't diagnose sleep-disordered breathing, right?
Correct. However, we can screen for it. So when I see a child that I suspect could have issues with sleep, I ask the right questions, both from the child and the parent, depending on how old the child is. And if it leads me to believe that they do have an issue, then that's the time to contact the pediatrician and perhaps try to get a sleep study performed on them.
Like they do with adults, where they put the monitors
yes.
all over your head?
Correct. For children, it's a little bit different, but same, pretty much the same process. The parent usually is allowed to be in the room with the child, depending on how old they are. But yes, it's pretty much the same process. They are attached to a medical monitor, to a sleep monitor, where their sleep is closely monitored throughout the night.
Vito in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Feruzian. Hi, Vito.
Yes, how are you today? Thanks for the chance.
Sure.
My question is that I have a 4-year-old boy, and he grounds his teeth sometimes when he sleeps, and I just is this a concern for parents to pay attention for this thing?
So he has a bruxism,
kind of,
yeah.
That's a great question. Yes, actually, that is one of the telltale signs of sleep and breathing issues. If the child is grinding their teeth, or if there's a lot of wear on their primary or baby teeth, and it is a result of the attempt to open up the airway. So they're clenching their teeth to try to create a little bit better airway and airflow. So that I would definitely have them looked at, have the tonsils and adenoids looked at to see if they're causing an issue, and have the dentist look at the teeth as well.
Vito, thanks a lot for that call. Why would it affect some children and not others? Are there some children who sleep with their mouth open or breathe through their mouth and during sleep that don't develop a lot of these symptoms?
I think as with any condition, some people, including children, are more prone to it, more susceptible to it. The host of symptoms and the list of symptoms is so large that it just depends on what the weakest link is in that chain. Some kids will grind their teeth and they don't have many of the other symptoms, and some will have the, for example, the bedwetting or the night sweats or sleepwalking, and we don't see much in the way of bruxism or tooth wear.
What does bedwetting have to do with the sleep disorder?
It's believed it has to do with the endocrine system. I'm not completely familiar with the mechanism, but it has to do with the hormones and the changes in the hormone balance of the body that causes both bedwetting as well as night sweats.
How big of a deal is this getting to be? Because when I was growing up, it was just nothing. I mean, you never heard anything about any of this stuff as far as children were going, or 20 years ago when I had my own child.
Well, I think as we have become more aware of sleep disorders in general, both adults and children, it's become more and more apparent. I think the problem has been there probably for a long time. We just didn't know what to look for. Uh-huh. And now we're much more aware. And I think speaking for myself as a dentist, I can definitely see certain patterns because I treat older adults for sleep apnea as well as jaw problems. I see the trend, how it's developing in younger kids. And I'm very fortunate to be able to recognize it early on and try to address it as quickly as possible.
Is sleep disordered breathing the same thing as sleep apnea?
Sleep disordered breathing is a general term. It's a broader term.
Okay.
Under sleep disordered breathing, then we have three, if you would, severities.
Uh-huh.
So primary snoring is the first one. The next one is called upper airway resistance syndrome. So that's sort of the middle of the road as far as severity. And then obstructive sleep apnea is the third one. And it's the most serious. That's where the breathing can actually be completely halted during sleep.
And how does a dentist treat for sleep disorders like this?
For children, we typically will try to, if the adenoids and the tonsils are the main issue, we mm-hmm. try to get those out. And the next step would be to look at the development of the jaw bones. If they have a very narrow arch, let's get them into expanders and try to widen the arches, because that will open up their nasal passage.
Okay.
And then try to get them into a correct tongue posture and promote nasal breathing. Really, that should be the goal ultimately, is to correct tongue posture and turn them from mouth breathers to nasal breathers.
How do you change tongue posture, particularly in a child?
Well, luckily, there are certain appliances that we can use that promote that. Healthy Start is one that I use that's been very successful, and it's been around a long time.
Uh-huh.
And the child will sleep with this appliance, and it literally will help them position their tongue up on the roof of their mouth. It's designed so that it restricts tongue movement to the roof of the mouth. Which is where it's supposed to be. And
okay.
It also helps to bring their lower jaw forward, and more importantly, keeps their mouth closed. Because every time the child opens their mouth, the airway actually closes down more. So if the mouth is open, the airway tends to collapse more. So anything we can do to hold that jaw forward, keep the mouth closed, and keep the tongue posture where it should be is very helpful.
Well, Dr. Michael Feruzian, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's Dr. Michael Feruzian. He's a pediatric dentist and orthodontist at the Center for Family and Cosmetic Dentistry. We've been talking about sleep disordered breathing in children. Thanks for listening today. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.